That night, your great guns unawares shook all our coffins as we lay, and broke the chancel window squares. We thought it was the judgment day, and sat upright while dreary summer rose the howl of wakened hounds. The mouse let fall the altar crumb. The worms drew back into their mounds. The glebe cow drooled. Its gunnery practice out at sea, just as before you went below. The world is as it used to be. All nations striving strong to make that warrior redder. Christ's sake, then you are helpless in such matters. And this is not the judgment hour, for some of them's a blessed thing, for if it were they have to suffer, hell's below for so much threatening. Aha! It will be warmer when I blow. Skeleton shook his head instead of preaching 40 years. My neighbor parson thirdly said, I wish I had stuck to pipes and beer. Readiness! as far in land as stout and tall, and Camelot and starlit Stonehenge.
Good evening, everyone. My name is John Brancy.
Peter Dugan here.
We're so happy to be here with you all tonight and presenting this program in conjunction with the Collaborative Arts Institute of Chicago. Thank you so much for having us here today. And thank you also to the University of Chicago for having us here in this beautiful venue. Thomas Hardy's description of endless and senseless war that you just heard was ironically written a few months before the outbreak of World War I. Although neither Finzi, the composer, nor Hardy saw action on the front lines, their lives and the lives of many other artists of the time were deeply affected and changed by the war.
At the outbreak of World War I, Great Britain was experiencing a sort of musical renaissance. For the first time in 150 years, the country, with the help of the newly established Royal Academy of Music, was beginning to produce dozens of composers who were writing music at the highest caliber. And although World War I was, of course, terrible in all ways, there was something about the war that actually helped to solidify and, in fact, intensify Britain's unique musical language. And that is a style that is imbued with references to folk music, a lot of nostalgia, pleasing melodies, harmonious sounds, all things which stand in stark contrast to what was going on at the same time in continental Europe, that general modernist movement that we have certain associations with. What you'll hear tonight is quite the opposite.
George Butterworth was undoubtedly one of the most promising composers of this generation, and had he not died in the war, he would have likely achieved the iconic status of Vaughan Williams, and later Benjamin Britten. Butterworth was a celebrated soldier who tragically lost his life to a sniper's bullet during the Battle of Somme at the age of 31. A Shropshire Lad, which Butterworth wrote just before his untimely death, ironically tells a tale of life that ends too soon. My 80 years and 10, 20 will not come again, and take from 70 springs a score, it only leaves me 50 more. And since to look
look at things in bloom. 50 springs are little room about the woodlands. I will go to see the cherry hung with snow. 1 and 20, I heard a wise man say, give crowns and pounds and guineas, but not your heart away. Give pearls away and rubies, but keep your fancy free. But I was 1 and 20, no use to talk to me. When I was 1 and 20, I heard him say again, the heart out of the bosom was never given in vain. 'Tis paid with sighs a plenty and sold for endless rue. And I am 2 and 20, and oh, 'tis true, 'tis true. See, and there you'll find your face too clear, and love it and be lost like me. One the long night through must lie, spent in star-defeated sighs. But why should you, as well as I, perish? Gaze not. Lad, as I hear tell, one that many loved in vain, looked into a forest well, and never looked away again. There, when the turf in springtime flowers, with downward eye and gazes sad, stands amid the glancing showers, a jonquil, not a Grecian lad. Think no more, I love me, Charlie. Why should men make haste to die? Empty heads and tongues are talking, make the rough road easy walking, and the feather page of folly bears the falling sky. Oh, 'tis jesting, dancing, drinking spins the heavy world around. If young hearts were not so clever, oh, they would be young forever. Think no more, 'tis only thinking lays lads underground. Think no more, laugh me jolly. Why should men make haste to die? Empty heads and tongues are talking, make the rough road easy walking, and the heather fate of folly bears the falling sky. The lads in their hundreds to Ludlow come in for the fair. The There's men from the barn and the forge and the mill and the fold. The lads for the girls and the lads for the liquor are there, and there with the rest are the lads that will never be old. There's chaps from the cart and the field and the till and the cart, and many to count are the stalwart and many the brave, and many the handsome of face and the handsome of heart, and few that will carry their looks or their truth to the grave. I wish one could know them, I wish there were tokens to tell the fortunate fellows that now you can never discern, and then one could talk with them friendly and wish them farewell, and watch them depart on the way that they will not return. And now you may stare as you like, and there's nothing to scan, and brushing your elbow unguessed and not to be told, they carry back bright to the coiner the mintage of man, the lads that will die glory and never be old. Horses trample, the harness jingles now. No change, though you lie under the land you used to plough. Is football playing along the river shore, with lads to chase the leather? Now I stand up no more. Aye, the ball is flying, the lads play heart and soul, the goal stands up, the keeper stands up to keep the goal. That I thought hard to leave, and has she tired of weeping as she lies down at eve? Aye, she lies down lightly, she lies not down to the girl is well contented. Be still, my lad, and sleep. Is my friend hearty while I am thin and pine? And has dead man's sweetheart. Never ask me whose.
Good evening. My name's John Wilkinson, and I'm honoured to be asked to talk to you this evening. I'll talk briefly about Houseman and Ivor Gurney, and take the opportunity to read a few poems by Ivor Gurney as well. The poets whose poems are being sung tonight situated their writing geographically in particular areas of England. Thomas Hardy in Wessex, centred on Dorset, A.E. Houseman in Shropshire, and Ivor Gurney and F.W. Harvey in Gloucestershire. There are strong claims, of course, in English language for landscape as formative of sensibility, most explicitly Wordsworth with the Lakes, while John Clare's poetry seems to emerge from Essex. Closer to our time, Basil Bunting's Brig Flats feels composed out of the stone and streams of Northumberland. But at no time in English poetry was regionalism so intense as from the close of the 19th century through the Great War and into the late 1920s. Regionalism as a term, though, subsumes various attitudes to the rural scene and rural life. Among these poetic places, Houseman, Shropshire is the most abstracted and distant, not quite nostalgic because it's a Shropshire of the mind, suffused with death and eroticism. Houseman's queer lyricism recasts the idyll of a Greek vase as a frieze of English rural scenes. The chief classical scholar of his age, Houseman yearned for an ideal Greek homeland, aesthetic and sexual. His poetry feels like a lament for physically inexpressible love, a graveyard of longing. This poetry's popularity after the Great War connected it to a national lament for a generation of young men of whom Shropshire lads became emblematic. Those dying in Flanders belonged to regiments not only named after areas of England, but drawn from those areas, men and officers alike. Longing, death, and mourning were re-territorialized after the Great War in Houseman's poems and in monuments in every village, as you know from Downton Abbey. Even if later the war would be more often remembered through Wilfred Owen's trench poetry in mud and bodies rather than idealized countryside. Butterworth's settings of Houseman, which we've just heard, were sadly premonitory too, since they were composed in 1910 to 11, before the outset of the war in which he died. Like many men of privileged background commissioned as officers, he developed an intense admiration for those he led, in his case, miners from Durham, a salutary reminder that the local can be industrial. The program notes refer to Butterworth's interest in folk song, and he was an early member with Vaughan Williams and Cecil Sharp of the English Folk Song Society. Folk song isn't necessarily bucolic, as Durham miners' songs would have reminded Butterworth, and brass bands are as much part of folk music as bagpipes. Neither is an interest in folk song necessarily anti-modernist. Think about Bartok or Benjamin Britten, for instance. I want to stress this because of the tendency to patronize English composers as occupying a rural backwater, whereas, say, early Soviet art and music is seen as progressive in its use of folk materials. And these were poets and composers who encountered modernity red in tooth and claw, in Gatling guns and mortars. Even Thomas Hardy, a Victorian and a proudly regional writer, was akin to Zola in the pitilessness of his realist vision. I'm not going to be talking about Hardy because he's well known, but I can't resist recalling that the song we've just heard contains a line which seems to me the essence of realist anti-pastoral. The glebe cow drooled. The songs by Ivor Gurney we shall hear this evening were written in the trenches in Flanders, in horror, filth, and privation that beggar imagining. The first song to be composed, a setting of John Masefield's By the Beer Side, dates from 1916, when Gurney was working as a signaller, crawling over mud expanses under fire, between rotting bodies on that charnel ground, to fix the telephone wires communicating between trenches. What can be the tone of the closing lines, "Death opens unknown doors, it is most grand to die"? How can a setting written knee-deep in mud affirm such sentiments? That is for the song's interpreter to answer. By contrast, I'd like to read one of Gurney's own poems from the trenches. The Silent One. Who died on the wires and hung there, one of two? Who for his hours of life had chattered through infinite lovely chatter of Buck's accent, yet faced unbroken wires, stepped over and went, a noble fool, faithful to his stripes, and ended. But I, weak, hungry, and willing only for the chance of line, to fight in the line, lay down under unbroken wires, and saw the flashes, and kept unshaken. Till the politest voice, a finicking accent, said, "Do you think you might crawl through there? There's a hole." In the afraid darkness shot at, I smiled, as politely replied, "I'm afraid not, sir." There was no hole, no way to be seen. Nothing but chance of death after tearing of clothes. Kept flat and watched the darkness, hearing bullets whizzing, and thought of music and swore deep hearts, deep oaths. Polite to God, and retreated and came on again, again retreated, and a second time faced the screen. The officer's finicking accent marks Gurney's class position on the other side of the tracks from Butterworth's and contrasts with the regional specificity of the lovely chatter of Buck's accent. The phrase, "faithful to his stripes," is invested in this poem with terrible, heartbreaking power. What really haunts me, though, is the word screen. Although screen has a military usage, here surely it refers to the dead bodies displayed on barbed wire, a dead cinema. Not only was Gurney a great English songwriter, but he was a memorably strange poet. His poetry has in common with John Clare's, which hadn't been rediscovered when Gurney was writing, a deep familiarity with the natural world, as well as the obvious marks of mental distress. If it lacks Clare's almost hallucinatory observation, indeed it relies on recollection and the redolence of place names, it shares Clare's feeling for rural labor, and its rhythms feel connected to the lengthy walks both poets undertook habitually, even compulsively. This is the second of the three poems I'll read. Poem for End. So the last poem is laid flat in its place, and crickly with crucifix corner leaves from my face Elizabethans and night-working thoughts of such grace. And all the dawns that set my thoughts new to making, or crickly dusk that the beech leaves stirred to shaking, are put aside. There is a book ended, heart aching. Joy and sorrow, and all thoughts a poet thinks, walking or turning to music, the wrought-out links of fancy to fancy, by seven or by Artois links. Only what's false in this, blood itself would not save, sweat would not heighten. The dead master in his grave would my true following of him, my care approve. And more than he, I paid the prices of life, standing where Rome immortal heard October's strife, a war poet whose right of honor cuts falsehood like a knife. War poet, his right is of nobler steel, the careful sword, and night walker will not suffer of praise the word from the sleepers, the custom followers, the dead lives unstirred. Only who thought of England as 2,000 years must keep of today's life the proper anger and fears. England that was paid for by building and ploughing and tears. Ivor Gurney suffered from a schizoaffective disorder, which had an insidious pre-war onset and was scarcely affected by his trench experiences. In fact, the comradeship of trench life and the extreme physical hardship may have controlled his hallucinations, although his job as signaller perhaps influenced his later belief that he was controlled by electric forces. For the 15 years before his death in 1937, Gurney was confined to an asylum. His musical composition deteriorated into incoherence, but he continued until about 1929 to write poems occasionally as lucid, disciplined, and poignant as the late short poem with which I'll finish. And I think it's also, I have to say, an extraordinarily forward-looking poem, both in sentiment and aesthetically. It's called Sea Marge, Marge being the coast, the shore, the seashore. Pebbles are beneath, but we stand softly on them as on sand and watch the lacy edge of the swift sea, which patterns and with glorious music the sands and round stones. It talks ever of new patterns. And by the cliff edge there, the oakwood throws a shadow deeper to watch what new thing happens at the marge. Thank you.
Sick for my hills again, my hills again. To see above the seven plain on Scabbernade against the sky. Jagged Malvern with a train of shadows. Where the land is low, like a huge imprisoning again, my hills again. Western River, where the spring goes first of all. I know a sailor's village where the elm trees grow tall, and the folk in their walk and their half sea, half far away talk, bringing names of tales and brighter fames as live as them all. Oh, your river gliding to the sea, I'll never forget the seven while my life loves the sea. To wider waters all the old men have gone, to shores of great Atlantic I would love to look on, Baltimore and Boston City and the wide Hudson shore, that their fathers found in danger with a wartime risk to run. Oh, your river gliding to the west, of all the rivers yet I know I love seven. And songs in salty arms with sea pride in their hearts. Still I jump at any chance to cruise where Carolina's sand and pines he first in sight for English folk with pride and salutes. Oh, your river gliding to the sea, if you take me where I want to, I'll make shanties of thee. City built of marvelous earth, life was lived nobly there to give such beauty birth. Beauty was in that heart and in that eager understand. Death drifts the brain with dust and soils the young limbs' glory. Death makes the lovely soul to wander under the sky.
Well, that's a hard act to follow.
Yeah, beautiful. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, totally inspired everything we just did.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I don't think we've ever quite played those Gurney pieces in that way.
Yeah.
So thanks for that inspiration. The next composer, William Dennis Brown, is another young composer who showed great promise, who went to war and did not return. Like many of his contemporaries, his music draws heavily on earlier styles, much, much earlier styles, Renaissance and the like. And the tune that you'll hear in the piano part, as well as the text itself to this next song, comes both from the 17th century. And this song depicts the idea of the divine beloved, a woman so beautiful that she turns the floor into heaven when she dances and sings.
Brown passed off his wallet to a petty officer who was trying to bandage his wounds and told him to flee before his trench was retaken by enemy forces. Inside the wallet was a final letter to his close friend, the great British arts patron Edward Marsh. He wrote, "I've gone now too, not too badly, I hope. I'm luckier than Rupert because I fought. But there's no way to bury me as I buried him, so perhaps he's best off in the long run. Dent is looking after my music. Goodbye, my dear, and bless you always for your goodness to me."
Constant motion, even and glorious as the
World War I was a war of great ironies, hopes dashed, expectations reversed, unforeseen defeats and victories. One of the great challenges of the war was encountering modern warfare and technology while attempting to maintain what was becoming an outdated sporting approach to war. And in hindsight, the next two songs, which were popular tunes of the day, capture this irony beautifully. Good humor in the face of what was senseless and devastating destruction.
They were serving from the hillside, they were called in from the glen, and the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Let no tears add to their hardship as the soldiers pass along, and although your heart is breaking, make it sing this cheery song. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning, though pleading, help a nation in distress. Then we gave our glorious laddies, honor made us do no less. For no gallant son of Britain to a foreign yoke shall bend, and no Englishman is silent to the sacred call of friend. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning, for your lads are far away, they dream of home. There's a silver lining through the dark cloud shining. Turn the dark cloud inside out till the boys come home.
Back again.
We have one more for you. I don't think it really needs an introduction.
And all my grave will warm a spot.